This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, how are you both doing this evening?
Patriarchy's finer.
Thank God.
All right, dear doctors.
Glad somebody is paying attention.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, I was going to tell you, Doug, I'm going to just go ahead and without consent launch into small talk. So if you want to put on your tinfoil hat, this is a really, speaking of the patriarchy in charge, apparently Michael Burry, our friend, Dr. Michael Burry, had a Twitter account, which I can't believe I hadn't been following, apparently is gone now because the SEC paid him a visit, and took down his Twitter account. So, he's no longer posting about markets and prognostications. But this is where the tinfoil hat comes in. Evidently, just a couple of days ago, he posted a long treatise about pulling from some piece on Weimar Germany about how we're heading into similar hyperinflation.
Yeah.
And so he posted that. SEC showed up, shut down his Twitter account. So, you know,
that
proceed
is,
accordingly.
That is unfrickin' believable.
Yeah.
That is unbelievable. Yeah. So for people who don't know who Michael Burry is,
he's
Dr. Michael Burry.
Dr. Michael Burry.
Dr. Michael Burry is a much admired man in these quarters. For anybody that has not seen the fabulous movie The Big Short, Dr. Michael Burry is the savant-like character who saw this whole crash coming in 2007 and 2008. And bet the farm on it and wouldn't be dissuaded by all of his screaming investors. And
he's very unhappy investors
very unhappy
who
investors.
Could not understand what the hell he was doing.
And then they had to choke down a $5 billion win.
Poor them.
Yeah, Dr.
Those
Michael,
who didn't manage to sever their contracts in the meantime.
Right. So what a fabulous and interesting character. And I've been... watching a little bit of his stock picking, which is outstanding because he's an old school thinker in terms of he's not looking to use a bunch of technical analysis to try to predict things. And what he does instead is he diligently researches the underlying fundamentals. And so he was picking Apple as a big winner back in the late 90s when other people were not, when they were basically leaving it alone. So he, among many other things that he's done. So this is really interesting because I've been concerned for people who have talked to me personally, like Jen, that's why she's bringing this up, that I'm certainly concerned about the fiscal irresponsibility of our government here in the last, year or so. I think COVID is a grand excuse. Doesn't matter which party's in power. But it's been kind of a free for all, and it's getting looser and looser around the edges, and so I've been sniffing that we could be headed into some fairly substantial inflation. In fact, I would be surprised if we weren't. So the fact that Michael Burry is making the same kind of noises, except his are even louder and more alarming than mine. The fact that the SEC would shut down this guy's Twitter account is downright Nazi Germany.
Yeah, and I'm sure Twitter would deny, both the SEC and Twitter would deny that that's what happened, but the timing is pretty suspicious, and it's clear that they did, literally pay him a visit.
It's unbelievable.
So you need to button it up. Yeah.
Wow. Why would Michael Burry in a free society need to shut his mouth about anything? Are they worried that their market systems are so tenuous and haywire and corrupt that a very extraordinarily respected voice in the wilderness starts to warn people so that they can take appropriate action? They worry that their worthless house of cards is going to collapse. Wow. What an unbelievable thing to hear. And of course, I am hearing it for the first time from Jen, so I haven't got a personal fact check yet.
I just heard about it today, which is why I haven't had a chance to talk to you about it. But right. I couldn't hold back the news when you've got our dear friend, the good doctor.
Right, exactly.
You can see the scene in the next movie already with the, you know, he's sitting there barefoot in his office, just watching stock charts, and there's a knock on the door.
Yeah. Well, that was actually that was actually a closing comment in the movie. Was that he went to the federal government to try to explain to them what happened so that they could go after guilty parties and so forth. And nobody was interested, but they did come investigate him. It's like, wow. And now we have this bullshit. What an amazing story. So, oh well, such is life in modern America.
It's the more you think about it, the more plausible it seems. You know, you've got this sort of stimulus spending, you've got a pent-up demand, you've got basically an overheated market, very similar to Weimar circumstances with sort of the end-of-war spending. And, and also you've got parallel sort of sinking confidence in currency and crypto and you know, all of that is part of this story. So it could definitely lead to some interesting places.
Yeah, who knows?
Mo agrees.
Yeah, what an interesting space. Well, you know, I have no idea because I'm not a student, ever have been a student of deep economy and at that level. And I'm just a surface level, you know, sort of Milton Friedman neophyte understanding of this thing. But I certainly understand that when the federal government starts throwing trillions of dollars around, just so that people, I mean, people today are, numbers are so big and people are so immune. It's like we're living in Colombia where like you make $20 billion a year. And you're like, $20 billion of what? You know, is a guy that changes tires. Like, you don't even know what on earth this is. And when we start talking about, oh, yeah, there's another stimulus package for a couple of trillion, it's like people just shrug their shoulders. They have no idea what's involved here. They're just to run some little math for you so that you understand. You've got 350 million people in the country. So if the government spends $3 per head, that's $1 billion. If they spend $3,000 per head, it's $1 trillion. So that means that the government in the last year has rolled out, I don't know, $3-4 trillion worth of, quote, programs. That means they've rolled out, they've trotted out, you know, $12,000 per head is what's gone on up and over and above normal government operations. This is extraordinary. And so the... as a result, you know, it's almost inevitable they're not going to go into the there's only three ways the government can get money. They can essentially tax for it. They can also borrow it, but if they borrow it, they stick their finger into the capital markets as a bidder or a buyer of money. And if they do that, they drive up interest rates. Well, oh, they don't want to do that because that will then cause a business disaster. So as a result, what they do is they do the most palatable thing, which is to, in effect, through their processes that they utilize, effectively, they create currency or they create money out of thin air. They just
print
decree
more.
It. They just effectively drive up the... Yeah.
Yeah.
So when they do that, they do not raise the interest rates and they do not have to tax people for it. They just create it. And so the way this effectively works is as follows. Imagine that you have a little economy in your backyard where it's, you know, $2 for an apple and $1 for an orange, and there's a certain amount of apples and oranges around. They fluctuate a little bit depending upon which trees are in season. But let's just say that there's, you got a pretty bunch of stuff in the yard. And at any one point, there's 1,000 units worth of, we'll call them dollars. There's 1,000 units worth of apples and oranges. And so one guy owns one tree and the other guy owns a couple other trees. So you're trading this stuff around and you've got 1,000 sand dollars, okay? And let's suppose that just for fun that we make them paper. So you've got 1,000 $1 bills and you've got $1,000 for the stuff of the tree. So we can know that the average price of the average transaction is $1 as we keep trading these things around, okay? The problem is that suppose somebody that actually knows how to print that stuff decides one day to print up an extra 10 bucks. So you might say, okay, well, what difference does it make? It's just going to make that the average transaction is going to be $1.10. It's not going to be $1 anymore. That's what will happen. And I've had economics professors tell me, oh, no, that isn't going to happen. And it's like, you're a moron. Of course that's going to happen. Let's use your imagination to prove it. Suppose that instead of printing 10 extra dollars, I print 1,000 extra dollars. So now I've got $1,100 in the economy and I've got the same amount of fruit in the tree. What's going to happen to the price? Answer, it's going to be, whatever that is, $11 a fruit. That's what is precisely what's going to happen. So the general price level can only rise or fall depending upon two factors, essentially two factors. The rest of it's noise. The first factor is going to be how much stuff is in the economy, and the other factor is going to be how much money is in the economy. So that's why, a piece of bubble gum is, 2 million coronas in Cali, Colombia, or whatever the hell it is. It used to be three coronas, and now it's 2 million coronas. Why? Because they printed a hell of a lot of coronas. That's what they did.
I recently was reading do you know what inflation in Zimbabwe under Mugabe was? And this is before he died. This would have been like 2017. I don't even quite know what this number is, but I believe it was 5-6 trillion percent.
Oh my God.
Like, I don't know how many zeros that is. I don't know how to calculate that, right. But that was the guy just printed money endlessly.
Yes. And let me explain for people just because your fault, Jen.
$100 million bills, right?
Yeah.
They did.
Yeah. So here's the deal.
Yeah.
So here's the deal. So what's going to happen is that if you are the first person that prints, you're the person that prints that 10 bucks in our little backyard economy, where there's 100 apples and oranges and $100, if you're the first person to spend the money, everybody actually believes that, an orange is worth $1, okay? Nobody knows that an orange is actually worth $1.10. They don't know that. You're the only one that knows. So you are entering the market with a bunch of naive traders, and you are getting goods cheaper. That, in other words, you're stealing money out of the market by virtue, not just for the fact that you printed the money, but you're actually also getting the value in that trade that is the market is naive to what the actual supply and demand of the money situation is. So the government steals in two ways. Not only do they print the money up out of thin air so that they don't have to earn it through legitimate tax processes, and they don't have to borrow it like every other capitalist has to borrow it. No. They just print it up. And they attack the market first before anybody knows what the hell's going on. Okay? Now, what's happening here is that because of that process, essentially interest rates are artificially low as the government starts sucking capital. And so what's happening is that everybody through that entire system is actually miscalibrated as to all of the values in the society. So you're creating quietly economic chaos. But in particularly, one group of people is being penalized. And the group of people that is being penalized are the people that are creditors.
So, well, and one group of people is being enriched, and which is the people who are the first movers.
The first movers are being enriched. And also, anybody that is holding a very long-term, low-interest debt, those people are also being enriched, okay? It turns out that the United States government is by far the biggest long-term low-interest debtor in the world. Nobody else is even close. So the United States government essentially monetizes its debt, devaluing the value of that debt to all the creditors. Those creditors are everybody that's going to depend on or receive Social Security, because your Social Security is money that you put in there. Effectively, the net value of that Social Security is being debased by your government. They'll give you a little 1.8 CPA adjustment. CPI adjustment. Meanwhile, they'll inflate the currency at 4.6%, and they'll never tell you because they'll use a bogus statistics program. So they'll just eat away at your income they'll just chip away at 2-3% a year. That's how they're stealing the money. Okay? That's one way they steal it. They steal it in a whole lot of ways, but a big way, anybody that is a conservative, reasonable, responsible, conscientious investor that is carefully trying to put their money in careful instruments, bond issues, things of that nature, forget it. You're going to get hosed. But you're going to get hosed slowly enough that you're like a frog in water and you don't even know you're being cooked. But that is exactly what this is up to. So this is a disgusting process. And it's always sort of going on at a low level and it doesn't really get my attention and I don't really care. But now suddenly we're finding that they've taken the gloves off and they're going after they're going after the responsible people very hard. And therefore, the wise people that can sniff the wind are getting themselves into long term low interest debt by buying real estate right now. That's why the real estate market is booming. People haven't conceptually figured this out. They actually accidentally can sniff it as they see the prices rise consistently, and they understand that the payments, even though a price might be very high because the interest rates are so low, i.e., they're artificially low, given how indebted and continually more indebted the U.S. government gets, the interest rates are truly artificially low right now. This is a superb time to get into long-term low-interest debt. So, I could be wrong, as Michael Burry would say.
Yeah, I don't see how.
I just don't see how. So anyway.
Oh, man.
That's, wow. They muzzled Michael Burry, of all people.
Yeah.
And for all things. This is not a guy that's inciting riots, talking anti-vax or anything else under the sun. No, this guy is talking about the American economy, for God's sakes. And who has more credibility than him? And that is exactly why they're muzzling him.
That's exactly why. I don't know how many followers he had. I wasn't aware that he was on Twitter. I would have been following him. But very interesting timing, to say the least.
Wow. So, outrageous.
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
Hey, you know what? We all, you know what? Everybody's... Yes, little by little, a lot of people are waking up, which is a strange thing. I don't know. I don't pretend to know anything about this area, hardly at all, which is cryptocurrency. It's a shame because the people that started it, I guess, are a bunch of libertarian, what do you call it?
Jeffrey Miller knows a lot about it. We should have him on the show to talk about it.
Oh my God, that's hilarious!
It's his new sort of core cause. He's moved on from concern about AI to crypto. That's his thing.
That's his new thing. Well, the interesting thing to me about it, you can't be awakened in the United States and not be aware of crypto at this point. And so the thing about it is, you're the one that drew my attention, Jen, to the notion that the more weird it gets in terms of how things are managed, the sort of top down muscle management of both government and high tech, the more that happens, the more paranoid people like Jeffrey Miller and others get. And then the more, it's interesting how much money has drifted into cryptocurrency in the last year or two. It's astonishing. This is no longer small money. Okay. $100 billion here, $100 billion there. That's not going to get anybody's attention. But when you start getting over $1 trillion invested in an asset class, that's sniffing like an awful lot of people, and basically institutional investors as well. Elon Musk coming in. This is telling you that a lot of smart people are feeling pretty damn paranoid.
Yeah, well, i.e. Yeah. confidence in currency being right. one of the factors that drives hyperinflation. So right. it's like the political and economic forces are working together to produce a very quasi-apocalyptic scenario.
Oh, no.
So... I mean, I think a little paranoia is warranted at this moment.
Well, for the record, everybody, I don't see anything apocalyptic, but I do see possibly a mini 1970s.
I was going to say 70s-esque. Yeah.
70s-esque. I don't think,
no small thing.
No, it's not. And lives will be wrecked divorces will be had over financial stressors that are completely and utterly unnecessary, that are caused
houses
by...
Houses will be lost. Crime will go up.
All
the narratives continue to be fed.
Yeah. Yeah, i.e. The Brad Pitt line, you know, in The Big Short, when the little guy was dancing because he knew he had made a fortune, he said, don't dance. Okay, this is a tragedy. Yeah. And
don't look like you're enjoying it too much.
Yeah, don't look like you're enjoying it too much. Like, you know, I personally feel pretty well insulated. I could be wrong. You know what I mean? It could get way worse. I don't think so. But I do think that an awful lot of money will be effectively stolen and transferred. And, you know, be aware that it's probably wise for any of our listeners that are within influence. You know, a lot of our listeners are international and it doesn't have anything to do with them. But for those of you here, you know, just realize that that if you're sitting on low risk, you know, high cash positions right now is a major thing, or Social Security or anything else, they're coming after you. Now, they're not going to come after you with an enormous claw. They're coming after you with little bites. And they will erode your net worth in the world by these actions. This is the most aggressive period of action of this kind that we've seen since the late 1970s. So what the hell? And they're going to shut up. Unlike the 1970s, the so-called gold bugs that were the libertarian-esque people. These are people like Harry Brown and Jerome Smith. These guys led the interest in precious metals. Cryptocurrency is sort of the new wave and the new look at this. It smells similar similar kinds of concerns and paranoia, etc. I remember the gold bugs in the day were all talking about where do you hide your gold and how do you transport it.
Yeah, it's really the same conversation.
Yeah, it is. It's fascinating. It's just 45 years later. But, you know, we've had different kinds of collapses, but we haven't had, you know, the collapse of 07-08 was mismanagement of government was the cause ultimately of that collapse, which is not actually told in The Big Short, but that is the fundamental truth there. That was actually the root cause of that thing. And then of course Wall Street does its corrupt thing that it does, but you know, that's fair enough. The that never happens without the government disturbing the normal market forces of the mortgage market. So this one, though, this is now behind, I could just see behind the excuse of the coronavirus, basically this these massive government intervention expensive, really wealth transfer programs, largely
infrastructure.
Yeah, in quote, infrastructure. That means my brother-in-law has a paving company in San Antonio, and he needs a big fat contract. That's what infrastructure means. And so, yeah, this all can sound good, but the truth of the matter is, whenever you see government writing checks of this size, you know, you're looking at payola. You're not looking at, particularly in a time when the government's already been running massive deficits. Already. So this is all very, you know, this is very 70-esque, and it smells like economic troubles times ahead. So, you know, be smart, get aware, and whatever else. I don't know what else I would tell people other than Michael Burry might be somebody you would want to be listening to if you can find him.
Yeah, well, I think he can, if he's not on Twitter anymore, you can definitely, he'll move with everybody else to the free speech platforms. Yeah. The SEC can't get him, the ones that are hosted.
Was promoting?
Trump's been promoting a couple of them, but Gab, you know, Gab, right, is sort of the big one. Yeah, they're holding a space for him over there. And I think Gab in part is hosted on Russian servers, which is just hilarious to me that this is the free speech solution, is the former Soviet Union is routing our free speech traffic.
It's insane.
That's where we are. So yeah, there's Gab, there's, you know, the various other platforms. I'm not familiar with all of them, but I'm sure he'll resurface somewhere.
Yeah. And it's, so now we had a perfectly nice situation, and all we had to do was have the big players just continue to get rich and just be reasonable. And no, you're not going to be reasonable. I don't know what this issue is with Twitter and the SEC and Michael Burry, but whatever it is, it stinks to high heaven. And yeah, so we're going to have now more concerted effort into new platforms, and that's fine. And it sort of splinters things. I kind of liked it the way it was, nicely organized. It was fine. All we needed was, you know, reasonable, and we didn't get it. So what the hell? On we go. But I don't like the idea of this stuff being routed through the Soviet Union, for God's sakes. It's like, come on, people.
Well, no. Not the Soviet Union anymore, but oh, yeah. It is whatever. Very Soviet-esque. Yeah.
CCCP.
I don't know that it's measurably
same,
that
similar
different.
Similar genes, yeah. Though, right? Is that what?
Yeah. Yeah, what were you asking, yeah. Nathan? You had some question come up.
Oh, just curious if you were if you had any opinions about the different cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, Ethereum, Dogecoin maybe even.
I don't know.
Dogecoin. Everybody should rush to invest in Dogecoin while you still can. That's my favorite.
I actually am such a neophyte. I just have no way to give anybody advice at all. So all I can say is that, you know, I thought the whole thing was just basically a fascinating pump and dump scheme. And now it has such traction. And I don't know if other people are impressed by this kind of thing. And maybe it's just a little stars in my eyes. But when an Elon Musk puts $1 billion into something, or whatever the hell it is he put in, it's like, whoa, that wasn't a short-term investment strategy.
To be fair, Elon Musk also thinks we're living in a video game simulation. So.
Got it. Okay, good, good. I don't know anything. I don't know enough about Elon Musk to know anything other than he's a successful business guy. So that, I guess that's...
Yeah, he's a bit of a wackadoo.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay, well...
Dr. Hawk,
let's hope,
am I hearing that we're going to see a Twitter for Dr. Lyle in his near future, hosted by the Eastine Dynamics platform?
No, we might have to get Doug on Twitter before it's too late, before they cancel
I want to be
Dr. Lyle. It would be
I
a badge
be banned
of
from Twitter.
No, it would be a badge of
yeah,
honor.
That's right.
Get a Twitter account, and then get banned, and then you can join the crowd afterwards.
Oh God, that would be all very exciting. Yeah, that's all good.
There has been a lot of complaints on Twitter with people posting screenshots of Trump's press releases. Mm-hmm. People saying he was banned for a reason and you don't need to share. It's like, okay, seriously? we can't even pass on information in the public square whatsoever. So yeah, it's completely disastrous, and it's just getting more and more polarized. So yeah, I don't think Doug would make it very long.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's good. That's good. I like that. But anyway, yeah, the answer is I don't know nearly enough about cryptocurrency to comment at all on it. And so all I know is that it's a red hot space. And when I start to see, you know, basically pretty amazingly irresponsible spending patterns on the part of the federal government, then I start understanding why people are starting to look for, you know, other places to put their money. Now, for me, I just soon put it in people in the that are in the stock market that are looking to hold real estate with big long-term low-interest mortgages. Public storage, for example.
Sounds like a very Virgo thing to do. Just put it in the mutual fund.
All right, Nathan, what else is going on? What do we got?
Well, we've got a few questions here, and so we'll see how many we can get through. But I really appreciate the little bit of the political and the economic talk, because I think it ties in really well to the psychology side of things. So, yeah, our first question is not political related. It's not economic, but it is economic related, about a lady who is asking for some job advice. So, dear doctors, I'm a single 60-year-old woman. I was laid off from my data analyst job 2 years from retirement. I've been collecting unemployment, which has been extended to all the COVID due to all the COVID stuff until September of this year. I've been pursuing employment and have come up on 3 different job opportunities. One is working in the police force as a financial analyst, but landing this position has involved jumping through a lot of hoops, background checks, transcripts, polygraph exam, etc. Second job involves working for a high technology company, 4 separate interviews. Third job is from the place that laid me off, interestingly enough. So here's my dilemma. I'm going quite crazy sitting around the house collecting unemployment. I work out, I have written a book, but I need some human interaction, even though I am an introvert. But it seems like these jobs all have qualities that make me question if I should take them. Like the police job. Do I really want to work for an establishment that hauls people to jail for not wearing a mask? The way society is changing, do I want to spend my valuable days putting in effort toward an organization that blindly upholds the norms of a society that I don't necessarily agree with? The high-tech job entails writing computer programs to help implement 5G technology, which I know 5G is coming, whether I work on it or not, but I feel guilty porting my efforts towards it if I don't agree. The third job, where I worked before, involves conducting scientific research on the long-term effect of COVID vaccines. I feel bad about this job, too. I don't think anyone should ever receive the vaccine, and it will be sad and depressing to watch the fallout. What the hell is wrong with me? I need the money, and I need companionship. It's hard to get a job in this economy, and I have worked so hard to get these interviews. Why am I so confused about which job to take? Maybe I should just forget it and sit around on unemployment. Help, I have to make this decision in the next 2 weeks.
Well, Jen, you just go right ahead and comment.
Boy, I don't know. There's a lot going on in this question. I mean, I think you need to break down the two needs that you have. One is for money, one is for sort of human companionship and to feel of use to the village. So those are two different things. And I would wonder, 2 years from retirement, you know, what is your monetary situation? Like, how, these all sound like fairly fancy jobs. These are three, you know, highly skilled jobs that are definitely a good fit for what you've been trained in and what you're able to do, even though they present these, I would say, pretty intractable ethical problems. I mean, if they're this at odds with your personal and political convictions before you sign on the dotted line, I think you're putting yourself in a pretty bad situation going into any of those workplaces long term, and you're not going to get. You're putting yourself in a situation where you're not going to be able to get the village feedback that you're desperately craving, because you're not going to be able to bring your best self to that job. You're not going to feel completely uncomplicated and prepared to do your best work if you're at odds with the mission. And that means that you're going to be kind of suffering an esteem handicap, essentially. You're not going to be getting the full kind of feedback that you deserve. So I think if you're feeling that strongly about all three of them going in, I would be really questioning whether you should take any of these three and thinking about applying at Starbucks. You know, like, if it's really just a matter of needing a little bit of money. If you're in significantly more financial distress than that, I don't know how long you're able to continue collecting the unemployment, but holding out for a job that's a better fit with your values seems like a fairly reasonable compromise. And then just doing something in the meantime to give you this social outlet that you're craving, whether it's a job, I say that somewhat facetiously as someone who actually did work at Starbucks for a while, like that, where you can have some connection and feel you've got something to do during the day, or just volunteering somewhere and meeting some people that way. and then looking for something that just makes more sense in the medium and long term. I think all three of these, just the way that you're talking about them and already presenting such a mixed CV, it's sounding to me like all three of those are bad roads for you. That's my take on it.
I vote.
Doug's more responsible than I am.
Well, I vote going to Starbucks. Nothing like having to face a bunch of coffee addicts before they have their coffee to realize just how much he needs that human interaction.
Yeah. It's a tough job, man.
I'll bet. My take is a little different because as Jen has signaled, this we can't give a good answer to this because we actually don't know the person's parameter situation. So 2 years from retirement has obviously been a high intelligence, high skilled person for a long time, probably. We have, she says, quote, needs the money, but that's a really funny word to use. Needs the money, how much, how badly, and how much, and for how long, and for what?
So, what could you sell instead?
Right.
Like, you know, how close to freedom are you really without having any of these jobs?
Yeah, I had somebody whining about some recent expenses that came up, and I said, well, do you have anything to sell? And they said, well, other than the 1928 classic Steinway that's in my parlor.
Oh my gosh. You run into that a lot, you know, oh, other than that, other than the vacation home, you know, other than the extra condo, like, this requires a little bit of forensic analysis.
Right. So, I would say, because on the one hand, depending upon what your situation is, my attitude is be fortunate that you have any choices at all. Okay. And that may be part of the dissonance that's going on is that you are hinting from the marketplace with three offers that if there's three offers, there might be a fourth. And that's sort of, I think, also going on in Jen's computation, that if you have that kind of a resume that actually has resulted in three job offers and you've got till September on unemployment, hell, you know what I mean? The odds of you coming up with a fourth are pretty damn good. So I think that's in the background, but you know, it all depends upon your natural risk tolerance. And I think that you've got enough risk tolerance that you are hemming and hawing and finding problems that are there and they bother you a little bit. You know what I mean? It's just kind of like shoes that don't quite fit or they don't fit very well at all. And so, yeah, my attitude is how bad do you need the shoes? What are you going to be walking on? And so that's the only way to answer that question is with more understanding and analysis of the real CVs that are involved. And, you know, if you're a few years from retirement, but you're exceedingly confident that you're going to be able to get a position sometime soon, you know, within the next 6 months, and you've got the resources to make that fly. And under the worst case scenario, you could go a year, even though you, quote, need the money, you've actually got the support, then you don't have to jump at any of these. So, yeah, we can't tell you. All we can do is sort of make conscious what some of the parameter estimations are that are actually going on inside of you that are giving you such high risk tolerance right now. So Jen's inferring that your risk tolerance is pretty high. Jen herself has very high risk tolerance. Jen will live in her own personally built yurt. Okay. So
it's
just
true.
Keep that in it's mind true. When you're listening to her answer.
I think that it's a fair risk tolerance if you're in a position to continue collecting unemployment to continue looking for another job. I mean, it depends. It really, like, it's impossible to answer without knowing what the situation is. But I just am picking up some clues in it that you sound like you're in a pretty good situation and could afford to do that, even if it stretches the wallet a little bit. And, you know, as long as you're ahead of this hyperinflation anyway.
Well, she's probably got some crypto. So then she's
yeah,
in good
well,
shape.
Good. Then nothing to worry about.
I had a question, not for this particular scenario, but just a couple of things that I picked up here about what I maybe perceive could be potentially enlightenment trap. Could you talk about the enlightenment trap and how it might play a role? Because I've heard this comment before from other people, and sometimes I'll feel this way where you say, oh, I don't know. I don't want to be doing this because it's, you know, essentially I'm above it or there's things that I don't agree with. And sometimes it feels like enlightenment trap. Sometimes it doesn't. But I'm just curious if you could comment on that.
Oh, that's
well,
very
I tried.
Yeah,
I tried to talk my way out. I don't know if Doug remembers this, but I very shortly after starting my job at Starbucks, which was, you know, endorsed at the time by Doug. I ran into the reality of that job actually being very difficult. So it's actually very stressful. You have to memorize all of the drinks and all of the permutations of the drinks, and you're dealing with a very high paced, disagreeable clientele that wants their stuff and they want it now. And not far into that, I was kind of looking for a way out, but I was looking for a way out that would cover my ass at the same time and protect my status. Yeah. And I remember trying to sell Doug on the idea that I just couldn't possibly work there anymore because of all of the animal products that they were selling.
That's a fascinating.
It's like, you know, they're just going, they're going through dozens and you know, so many gallons of milk a day and all of these horrible, it's basically just a burger and shake kind of place. And it's completely at odds with my ethical principles. And so I can't possibly be expected to work here any longer. It's completely unreasonable. And that was absolutely at the time I was aware that that was a defense protection mechanism, something akin to the Enlightenment trap. Mm-hmm. And Doug did not buy it. He was like, suck it up, finish your dissertation.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's really interesting. Yeah. Yeah. All good.
So that may be the case here. There's definitely, you know, that the flags that she's raising in terms of, you know, I think there is a point at which being in a certain type of employee doing certain type of work that is, you know, completely at odds with deeply mm-hmm. held values becomes a problem. So it may mm-hmm. look like may look a little Enlightenment trap-ish, but that doesn't mean that those two things are not still at odds. They can really truly be at odds. Yeah. So we just kind of don't know without talking to her.
Oh, good. Great. Good thinking though, Nathan. Good sixth sense there, sniffing that out. Good.
All right.
What else we got?
All right. Thank you. Our next question. Dr. Lyle has explained on the podcast that people are not inclined towards harmoniously living together in community, as was the utopian ideal of the 60s. But why is that? It would seem that our Stone Age brain would be wired for communal living, as surely we humans were far more communal in nature in the Stone Age than we are today. So why do you think intentional communities tend to fail? Wouldn't the default be interdependence, sharing and cooperation, and not rugged individualism?
Yeah, there's all kinds of misunderstandings here. So, Jen, feel free to pile in and make sure that I don't miss anything important, but I'll just give it to you quick and dirty. And that is that, that human beings live together in groups because the benefits of living in a group outweigh the costs. That doesn't mean it's harmonious and communal and helpful or anything else. It just means there's a tiny percent more benefit than there is cost. It turns out that when you look at those situations, they're not all helpful and nice. They've got deep conflicts, and huge conflicts arise between males over females. That is within villages, and it's also between villages. So that's a serious problem. Because this is not a little pair bond species where everybody just takes their one little thing and then everybody leaves everybody else alone. It's not even remotely close to that. And so there's all kinds of problems, and you don't have clear agreements. You don't have written law. You have, you know, basically disagreements about what was said, you know, I'm sorry. You got two cave men trying to grunt to each other, trying to figure out what the agreement was. They misunderstood each other and they're clubbing each other to death. Okay. This is not, the good news is they didn't have lawyers in the middle of it, you know, taking a piece of the action. So the truth of the matter is that we are vastly better off under civilized circumstances, which is why those things evolved naturally as you got large population bases based on the efficiency of agriculture. So it's not just that it also led to a warrior class and therefore larger accumulations of groups. It's also the case that people are better off. They're better off that the relief that takes place when a village of hunter-gatherers comes under the protection of the Leviathan national government is huge. suddenly the men don't have to like stick up for their honor and then go throw a spear into the other guy's back and then wind up being killed as a result of the retaliation. It's like, it's way better living this way. Okay, so there's a reason. So if you think about some idyllic thing in the 1960s, they're living somewhere in a nice place in Colorado, right? Oh, that sounds nice. So we're all peaceful, loving hippies that smoke pot and get along with each other until we start fighting about the women. But it isn't too bad. Why? Because you have a national defense. Okay? You're heavily dependent upon free market processes, whether you like it or not, because you go down to the little village and trade. Okay? God forbid you get into trouble. You know, somebody goes in and gets a local doctor, because the one guy that had 3 years at the naturopathic college that everybody thinks is going to be the doctor of the group isn't worth a damn thing. Okay? So, no, the answer is that we are extremely interdependent now, and trying to do it in your own little communal village is, in fact, rugged independence and individualism of the worst order, and it leads reliably to abject poverty. Okay? So, we're seeing the fact that the world gets to the following space where people don't have to depend upon each other and their neighbors and have agreements to defend themselves and to trade with each other with a limited, tiny little market of mediocre abilities. Instead, you get to trade indirectly to give your best to the market for the best that there is in the world for genius. Okay? So that's what you get to trade, and you get the protection of a national government, no matter how corrupt and incompetent. It is unbelievably good. I mean, that's the beauty of the United States. So I can criticize the hell out of it and roll my eyes and protect my wallet over its, you know, basically, you know, incompetence and corruption. But the truth of the matter is it's still unbelievably good. Okay, so we live here very safe. You also have a police force that people can bitch about and worry about being hauled away for masks or because of their, you know, got pulled over for their race or whatever issue anybody has with it. But the truth of the matter is, it's unbelievably good. Okay? So are there imperfections and errors? Yes. Is it really good? Yeah, it's really, really good. So, no, you're not going to beat a modern American society, which is why Jen says, let's not have it go down the tubes, people. Because we have it really, really good, and no, a communal living is a fiasco. You know, many people have tried, and a lot of times they've morphed into little rural outposts. In fact, my first book was published by the people at what's called The Farm down in Tennessee or wherever they are. Those were a bunch of hippies that were kind of into this whole thing, but then they realized they better trade with the market to make their lives better, and one of the things they turned into is publishing. And in fact, they publish little alternative books of weird opinions and not fancy authors, things like The Pleasure Trap. So, you know, very cool. And, you know, I've met those people and they're incredibly sweet, nice people, just like the kind and open, just like the kinds of people that you would expect to wind up at a place like that. And then they wound up, you know, raising their families and integrating back into the regular life to varying degrees, and all good, you know, basically living like rural entrepreneurs that are very peaceful, but they get to do so under a tremendous umbrella and infrastructure of, you know, American national and local government.
Yeah, I would say the other component of the failure of intentional communities is they're coming together behind a lot of ideological status games to start the whole thing off. So, you know, most of these things are vaguely cult-like and they have cult leaders who are defending their vision, and you have a lot of zero-sum status dynamics that are happening within that community from the get-go. So I think unless they turn into what Doug is describing, which is essentially a a community that is more broadly integrated with a larger market and just kind of exerting some membership rules over who's in and who's out, which is going to be a very effective way to run your little community. That's not the quite the same thing as what we tend to think of as an actual intentional community, which is we're going to go follow this guy and we're going to take ourselves into the wilderness and live deliberately around a certain set of ideas that are coming from him or her, but it's usually him. And then we're all going to be jockeying for proximity and favor and all of these things that emerge from that, whether it's a legitimate cult or not. So I think that's a big thing that is poisons these kinds of arrangements.
So would you recommend unintentional communities instead?
Yeah, well, that's what it sounds like Doug is describing with his little hippies who are just finding personal affinity with each other. They like each other's kind of approach to the world. They find some shared values, but they're not sort of opting out of the existing system to go try to do their own thing. That is something that is, I think, very rarely going to succeed. And there's also this question kind of raises the specter of this myth of Stone Age life being all egalitarian,
yes.
Which has really been pretty roundly debunked. A lot of that came from the Harvard, of course, it's Harvard's fault, the Harvard Kalahari Project, which was this group of anthropologists that found this tribe in the Kalahari and sort of identified all of their mystical rituals and cosmologies and sharing procedures and all of these things and was like, oh, well, we came from this, you know, sort of this very magical time in our history. And it's really just the dawn of agriculture and nation states that ruined it all. And I think that influenced a lot of this kind of paradigm that people think that it was, oh, yeah, we all shared equally. Everything was great. Yeah, Stone Age life was just as hierarchical and just as brutal, much more so than agricultural life. And so we've got these things very deep in our nature, and you can't gloss over them in any kind of community, intentional or not.
So I think to paraphrase Dr. Lyle's comment on marriage and apply it to this, you don't get an intentional community. You discover if you are part of an intentional community.
That's actually beautifully said.
That's really good.
Very good, Nathan. Yeah. Well done.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, thank you very much for the analysis. I really appreciate it. This some fun politics we get into, some economics, and then some application. I love it.
Well, I know I got some, we got some fans, the guys that I just love that know a lot about crypto. So if they can write to me and tell me what crypto to buy, I'll be much appreciated.
We need to collectively decide what crypto we're going to have in our intentional community when we opt out of society as we go into this sort of Blade Runner times.
That's just beautiful.
We got to get on this.
That's right.
Somebody needs to give Jeffrey Miller a call immediately.
That's right. Oh my God. The Gene coin. We need the Gene coin. Whatever.
Yeah.
All right.
The BYG coin.
BYG coin. Yeah, they all have three letters. So we want the BYG coin. That's right.
Oh my God.
Oh my goodness.
I'll stick with my gold bars. Yeah.
There you go. That's good. Yeah. 1970s. There we go. All right, everybody. Well, thank you, Nathan.
All right,
Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle. Yeah. We'll chat with you guys next time and have a wonderful rest of the evening. Thank you.
Fantastic,
you too.
Nathan.
See you next time. Bye.
Gotcha. Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.